Radio. Across the UK. Online. On DAB. And on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. On Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. It is, of course, the home of common sense. It's also the world headquarters of the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth. We have much to discuss this morning and we are kicking off with Brendan Chilton, the last sensible man left in the Labour Party, with his view on what's going on out there. Boris Johnson has been accused of bungling his speech yesterday and failing to show respect for the business community and the CBI. But did he really do that by accident? I, for one, am not buying it, because when you see Boris Johnson messing up to the tune of 150%, you know that he has planned every single second of that. If you watch the Boris Johnson speech, and we'll play it out later on in this hour for you, if you watch what he's doing, there is absolutely no way on earth, in my view, that he is not pausing for effect, that he is not pretending to lose his place. He looks like a man who has absolutely total and utter control over his own failings. He looks like a man who has decided to look as though he is bungling. And why? Because everybody's talking about Boris Johnson this morning. Everybody's talking about what he did, why he did it, how he shows no respect for the CBI, which, by the way, I think he wanted them to know as well. But also, nobody's talking about the social care problems, which we're going to talk about on this show. I, for one, am not being thrown off the scent by Boris Johnson ruffling his hair metaphorically and pretending to stand at a lectern and not know what to say. This is a guy who plans every single thing that he does to the final nth degree. It might not work in every single arena, but certainly when he speaks publicly, I know precisely what he's doing, I know precisely what he means to do, and I know precisely what image he wants to put out there. And so I, for one, Mr. Prime Minister, am not taken in by your shambolic performance. I, for one, am not buying it, and I, for one, am accusing you of rather cynically throwing a dead cat onto the table and trying to make out that we should be talking about you instead of what's actually going on in the world. 0344 499 1000. He managed to get the main event through the House of Commons, by the way, by getting that social care bill passed last night, despite those dire warnings in The Guardian yesterday that he was facing a massive backbench revolt. They got that wrong then. Well done, guys. Another problem. There's also, however, a very ongoing disquiet undercurrent going on inside the back of the Tory party, at the back of the bus, if you like, because people are not happy about the immigration problem. They're not happy about Priti Patel and the migrants coming to the beaches every single day. They're not that happy about the green agenda. They're not that happy about the tax and spend policies. And so he does need a dead cat, doesn't he? He does need to get people distracted from the real things that are going on around him, and that's what he's done. 0344 499 1000. We're also continuing this morning to keep up the pressure on the parole board, even though they've refused to come on with us today. They've given us a statement. Dominic Raab is calling for a shake-up of the system so that it's more focused on victims instead of the criminals, and that's all, of course, in the wake of the Colin Pitchfork scandal that we told you would happen, and of course then did happen. We'll be talking to Professor of Criminology James Treadwell about that. Laura Dodsworth is here as well. She'll give us her take on the clampdowns on freedom sweeping across the European continent. Could it happen here? I don't think so, but Laura will tell us why exactly so many countries think that they should be locking up their own citizens and shooting bullets at them because they don't want to take a vaccine. Absolutely ridiculous. As ever, of course, you need to hear from you. 0344 499 1000. And of course, you will be hearing from many other people as well. Kevin O'Sullivan's here, LaDonna Harvey's around as well. And you're listening to me, Mike Graham, right here on the fastest growing radio station on the planet. It is, of course, Talk Radio.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Now, let us, without further ado, go to Brendan Chilton, CEO of the Independent Business Network, and, as I call him, the last sensible man left in the Labour Party. Brendan, a very good morning to you.
I wouldn't go as far to say sensible, Mike. Good morning
well,
to you.
It's all comparative, isn't it, Brendan? I mean, when you look at the rest of the mob in the Labour Party, you look like the most sensible one to me. But that's another story. Now, do you, like me, share this slight kind of suspicion that Boris Johnson and his performance yesterday is so ridiculously over the top that he must have done it deliberately? He must have planned to do it. Even if he started off by thinking, oh, I've lost my place, he then went on and on and on and grandstanded it and made it into a big thing, which everybody's now talking about. And people are so stupid that they've fallen for it. And they've basically gone, oh, but he's showing no respect to his audience. That's the point, isn't it?
It is entirely the point. We all know that Boris Johnson is a master performer and is also the master of the dead cat strategy.
Yes.
Namely, put something else out there to make them stop talking about the subject that you don't want them talking about. We've seen Boris Johnson before he goes live on telly mess up his hair. We've seen him, deliberately crack jokes at inappropriate times. We've seen him make sure the cameras are looking at him when he's doing it. I entirely agree with you, Mike. I think this is classic Boris Johnson, because today, right now, instead of talking about the myriad of issues that are going wrong in the country at the moment, we're talking, as everybody else is, about Boris Johnson, Peppa Pig, and his speech to the CBI, which is exactly what he wants.
Yes, exactly right. Except for, of course, the cunning plan that I've hatched here at the Independent Republic, which is to only talk about it in the context of it being a fake and only actually talking about the real issues because nobody else is doing it. So that's what we're going to do. But before we do that, we are going to play a little bit of what Boris had to say yesterday, how he said it and what it all looked like.
So with safer streets, with great local schools, with fantastic broadband... Forgive me. Forgive me. People will have the confidence to stay nearer.
See, there's no way, absolutely no chance in hell, Brendan, that that was genuine. No way at all. Because we've all done it, right? I mean, I do a radio show every day. You know, I occasionally lose my thread, forget where I am, or I'm about to talk about something, don't have a piece of paper to hand with somebody's name on it. You know, it does happen, but you don't do that. You never do that.
No, I think what he's done there is classic, isn't it? You know, he's you clearly see that he's got a speech in front of him. And, you know, he would not have been sent up there without a speech properly written. So this is clearly just an act to try and divert the attention from away from the issues that we're meant to be covering to, you know, a sort of Boris Johnson fluff again. And it's part of this attempt by the Prime Minister to make him seem like a sort of bumbling, innocent man that we all sort of think, oh, poor old Boris. It's one great act. And unfortunately, the British people tend to fall for it.
They really do. And that's the thing that surprised me. But let's talk about the big issues around him. I mean, there are three problems that Boris has currently. One is that he is now becoming known as the heaviest taxing prime minister since the last war, which is going back quite a long way. That's not particularly conservative, and it's not particularly what conservative voters expect. Second of all, he's got the migrant crisis, which I said at the weekend is in danger of not only engulfing the government, but engulfing the entire country. And you know a lot about that, Brendan, because it's happening in your backyard. And thirdly, the green agenda, which is driving people absolutely insane because they can't afford what it is that the government wants them to do. The net zero argument is fast disappearing and going down the gurgler. And so those three issues alone are enough, I would have thought, to be very concerning for anyone at the head of the Tory party.
I think you've hit the nail on the head there, Mike, and I would just add on to that, and it kind of comes in with taxation, the fact that our economy is stagnating.
Yeah.
There's no real growth in the economy. I think those three points are absolutely right. The levels of taxation this current country are currently facing are the highest since the war.
Yeah.
I don't even think people like Dennis Healey or the Labour Party in the old days would have gone so high. It's not good for growth. It's not good for our global competitiveness. The Prime Minister has also signed us up to an international minimum on corporation tax, which, if you wish to undercut your competitors and receive more investment in your country, doesn't seem to me to be a very sensible thing to do. On the migrant crisis, Mike, you and I have discussed this many, many times, and it seems as though, despite the fact we are now heading into winter, and I was walking down the coast at the weekend, I can tell you the sea is very choppy at the moment.
Yeah. But I mean, it's not stopping them coming at this time, though, is it?
No,
isn't. Normally at this time of year, you expect the numbers to drop off quite considerably, but they're not.
They're not. And as a matter of fact, they seem to be increasing. And the boats that are crossing the channel have been sort of upgraded and sort of made better for winter conditions. Mm. You know, they've sort of got more floats on them and things like this. And so this crisis isn't going away. And I have to say, for the Prime Minister and the Home Secretary to continue to sound off as they do on this, those are the guys in charge. They should be dealing with this. And I think many Conservative voters and many Labour voters, actually, don't like to see our immigration system being unfairly treated in this way. This country, I think, is broadly a welcoming country that would look after those in need. But when you're seeing people crossing the channel illegally, which is what they're doing, and getting into this country seemingly unhindered, they're very frustrated about it. And yes. Then finally, as you said on the climate agenda, the one thing no one's talking about is how expensive this is going to be for you, how expensive it's going to be for me and every other individual and business in this country. It's all very well going green, but when the people start to feel the costs of all this, I think there's going to be one hell of a backlash.
Well, there is. And already we're hearing and seeing changes being made sort of all around us without really anyone giving their say-so to it. All new build housing, for example, yesterday being told that they have to put in an electric charge point for a car. Now, that's all very well, but, you know, how easy will that be to do? How much money will that add on to the cost of supplying the house? And also, what are you connecting it up to? Because it's all very well to go, let's have an electric charge point in the middle of Shropshire, where we're building a new set of housing. But how does the electricity, obviously, which is going to be going into the house, how is that going to be plugged into the car? I mean, you know, there's a lot to think about here.
There is indeed. And on top of that, Mike, as well, you know, if people are going to be travelling around the country in electric cars, we're going to need charging points around the country in the yeah. same way that we've got petrol stations around the country. Now, you know, I can't imagine sort of rural or the sort of suburban parts of our cities are going to want these monumental electric charging points put at the end of their street for everyone to plug in and use. There are huge issues around all this. And of course, at the moment, the costs of these things are so high.
Yes.
Yet the government are going to be phasing out petrol and diesel cars in a very few years. But at the moment, there's no sign that these electric cars are coming down. So unless they want us to become a driverless society, I know at the moment it seems as though London is moving in that way, no one having cars and using public transport and walking. But the rest of the country that doesn't have very good public transport networks and the tube, etc., we need our cars. And I'm going to keep my gas-guzzling car despite the government's best efforts.
Well, exactly right, because you make a very good point. And I know this because of where I am at the weekends. Outside of London, the actual public transport network is hopeless, useless, right? I mean, you know, I had friends going up to London at the weekend on Saturday. The train was rerouted through Croydon for some reason or other, which was never explained, which added about 45 minutes to the journey time in both directions. And you're kind of going, it's Saturday, people are going Christmas shopping. What are you doing? And there was a bus service on from Sevenoaks into London. You know, I mean, it's just madness.
Well, this is just the, again, another demonstration, isn't it, of the disconnect between the sort of North London metropolitan elite that make the decisions in this country and how the rest of us live. Because in comfortable cities, you've got good public transport, you've got a Waitrose under every apartment block, you've got wonderful varieties of restaurants and cafes. If you live out in the rural areas, I know you go to at the weekend, I live down in Kent and people in other parts of this country, we don't have all that. And so we need our cars. And unless the government are going to make a huge investment in public transport, which I don't think they're going to do, you can't then expect people to give up their most convenient and most efficient method of travel. But again, this is the just one demonstration. We've spoken about tax. We've spoken about the migrant crisis, the economy and the green agenda, where our politicians are, frankly, on another planet compared to the rest of us.
Yes, exactly right. And I mean, the point is this, right? Because they're so far away from the general election, because they're no longer really under threat from the Labour Party, and I say that even after last week's PMQs where Keir Starmer actually appeared to look as if he was actually quite a decent leader of the opposition, I'm sure this week it will go back to normal because Keir Starmer hasn't really capitalised on the disquiet amongst the Tory ranks. He hasn't really capitalised on anything which has made his position stronger. You know, we saw last week, I think, for the first time, Labour leading in one or two of the polls. Now it's gone back the other way again.
I think, as I've always said, Mike, I think Labour has got to really up its game. As your listeners will know, I am a member of the Labour Party, and I think at the moment there are so many open goals that we could be scoring against this government. And while we're sort of landing some, we're not landing them hard enough.
No.
For example, we had at the weekend the discussion on the migrant crisis. Our shadow spokesperson simply just would not say that these crossings were a problem, that they needed to be stopped altogether. The phrase was, we need to find a safe route. But there is a safe route across the channel. It's a big stretch of ocean that's very dangerous, you know. And so people should not be coming across. On the climate agenda, you know, our party, the Labour Party, is very committed to this, but I think we're failing as well to understand how the cost transaction of all this is going to be offloaded onto people and how they're going to afford it. And then again, on the economy, we keep saying we want to make more in this country. We have hit the government hard, I think, on the contracts issue. But we need to be saying, what is our plan to get the British economy on turbo? Mm. And that comes back to lower taxes, lower regulation and policies to support a revival in manufacturing in this country. We do that and Britain will boom.
Absolutely right. Stay where you are, Brendan. We're going to come back to you in a moment. We've got a couple of things to ask you about as well. We're talking to Brendan Chilton. We're talking about the problems that Boris Johnson has got, that he cannot hide away just because he's pretending to have forgotten which page he was on his speech at the CBI yesterday.
This is Talk Radio. Across the UK. Online, on DAB+, and on the Talk Radio app. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. On Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham, right here on the, of course, home of common sense, which is Talk Radio. We're talking to Brendan Chilton from the Labour Party, also CEO of the Independent Business Network. I've been telling you how I'm not buying Boris Johnson's act, because that's entirely what it was yesterday, where he was pretending to lose his idea of what part of the speech he was making. He also made a reference to Peppa Pig, which everybody's making a great deal of. Let's have a look at this one.
Tony, yesterday I went, as we all must, to Peppa Pig World. I don't know if you've been to Peppa Pig World. Who's been to, hands up anybody who's been to Peppa Pig World? Not enough. I was a bit hazy what I would find at Peppa Pig World, but I loved it. And Peppa Pig World is very much my kind of place. Very safe streets, discipline in schools, heavy emphasis on new mass transit systems, I notice, even if they're a bit stereotypical about Daddy Pig.
I wonder if anybody's actually checked whether he was even at Peppa Pig World yesterday, but, you know, none of that happens by accident. Brendan and I think are in agreement about that. I haven't been to Peppa Pig World personally, and my kids are too old now to take them. I think they'd probably throw something at me if I tried to suggest it, Brendan. But, I mean... it's extraordinary, isn't it, that Boris continues to sort of get away with it, and there doesn't appear to be, from what I can see, any major strategy coming out of the Labour Party at the moment at all.
Well, it's exactly the same as when he told us that in his leisure time he paints crates and turns them into buses.
Yes, well, in fact, he famously told Talk Radio that famously, and that became the story for about the next week, didn't it?
He did indeed. I mean, I don't recall the last time he told us that he did that. And we all know why, because he's never painted a crate in his life.
We've also never seen one of these so-called crates that he's painted, have we?
Well, no, exactly. It's all an act. And unfortunately, the British people haven't got wise to this yet. Now, I think, as we were just saying earlier, Mike, I think the Labour Party right now, if it really wanted to, could tear this government apart on rising costs in our economy, to the fact that we've got a stagnating economy, a migrant crisis, as well as the whole question around the competence of ministers. We should be landing some heavy blows. Now, to be fair to Keir Starmer, the polls have narrowed. The Labour Party were ahead just last week. I know they've gone back again this week. But we're now moving into a position where the next big sort of political obstacle in the future is the next general election, which could come as early as late next year or in 2023. And if Labour want to win, we're going to have to up our game between now and then. If the government wish to survive, Tory MPs are really, I think, going to have to start questioning whether or not the right people are at the top of the Conservative Party at the moment.
Well, that's right, because we keep being told by almost everyone, which is always the way when you don't know how it's all going to turn out, that all these by-elections that are coming up are not important at all. You can't draw any conclusions from them because everything weird always happens at by-elections. However, I wonder if the Tories do better than they expect at these by-elections, whether Boris might go, well, hang on a minute, maybe this would be a good time to call an election in about, you know, 6 months' time.
It's entirely possible. We know that the government are repealing the Fixed Term Parliament Act. We know we've got boundary reviews coming in as well, which look as though they're going to be more favourable towards the Conservative Party. If I was Boris Johnson, and if in a few months' time I was back riding high in the polls, just having got through COVID, having got Brexit done, I'd go for a general election. At that point, Labour will need to be quite concerned. If, however, the fallout from the budget this year of increased taxation, more borrowing and all the rest of it, and the economy continues to flatline and possibly tank next year, the government could be in very sticky water very, very quickly. Mm. People are feeling the pinch out there at the moment. We do know that inflation is eating into people's pockets, and all these other measures as well that the government announced in the budget are not popular, particularly with business. And so we are in really, I think, sort of uncharted waters here. We've got a position where if there was an early general election at the moment, it's not entirely clear that the Conservatives would get their majority.
Yeah, exactly right. And Brexit's still there in the background, isn't it? I mean, people are pleased, I think, that we've left the European Union generally, apart from the sort of the Remainer nutters who are still hanging about saying we'd like to rejoin the European Union. And with all the things that are going on there at the moment, I think I'm very glad I'm not a member any longer of the European Union, where they seem to be very keen on shooting their own citizens just because they don't want to take a vaccine.
Well, I think you would never have thought, would you, that in modern Europe, after we've had fascism, the Soviet Union, the fall of the Berlin Wall, we would be in a position where democratic Western European nations were locking up their populations because they weren't vaccinated, were shooting their populations, or firing at them rather, because they were protesting, and where really freedom is in decline. I'm glad we're not in the European Union. I campaigned to leave, but I am deeply concerned about how the sort of traditional liberal democratic freedoms that we've held dear and really had taken for granted for centuries appear to be in sort of retreat as this sort of creeping authoritarianism and coercion from governments across Europe starts to take pace. And if it comes into this country where the government starts considering similar measures, we must totally oppose it. And if they insist on it, we must refuse to obey, because freedom is far more important than any power any government wants.
Absolutely right. Well said indeed. Brendan Chilton there, CEO of the Independent Business Network. I told you he was the last sensible person left in the Labour Party, and so he has proven, because we'll be talking a lot about what's going on in Europe coming up with Laura Dodsworth a little bit later on in the show. We've got more of your calls to take, of course, as well. 0344 499 1000. We'd like to hear from you as to what's going on out there. Are you being told anything interesting that you weren't being told last week? Are you able to see a doctor? Is that getting any better for you? Are you still struggling to get an appointment with the NHS? And what's going on at work? Are you being told that you might have to get a vaccine passport if you want to do something? Are you being told that you might have to start taking a test? Because we were told last night, funnily enough, by the government, that they might be doing away with all of the crazy testing. They might be doing away with all the paperwork you need to do to fill out to go abroad. All of that might be disappearing in the new year. I hope to God that's true.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Let's talk now, though, to James Treadwell, Professor of Criminology at Staffordshire University. We spent a great deal of time yesterday talking to several guests, including Alberto Costa, who is the local MP in Leicester, where Colin Pitchfork committed his heinous crimes all those years ago. He's been recalled to prison. There was some speculation that he was recalled to prison as a result of his behaviour. Having been released in September, he was seen supposedly talking to young women, trying to convince teenagers, some of them, to talk to him. It's all very murky. The parole board and what they do is all really rather murky. This morning on the front page of the Daily Mail, Dominic Raab is quoted as saying that the system is adrift from its core purpose, and he wants to see a root and branch reform of the parole board in order to make it more user-friendly for victims of crime rather than for the actual criminals. Let's find out what James thinks. James, very good morning to you.
Morning, Mike.
Thanks very much for joining us. I mean, the parole board, we asked to come on yesterday and today. They've refused to come on and talk to us, but they've issued a statement which is pretty difficult to kind of to interpret, really. But they're basically telling us all about how he was released and the decisions that were made and how the Secretary of State was involved and, you know, all of that. What they don't say is how they got it wrong massively, and he did exactly what we said he would do if you let the guy out.
Absolutely. And I said, you know, some people I think are beyond the pale. They should never be released. And he is one of those cases.
Yeah.
And that's not from someone who doesn't believe in any form of offender rehabilitation. I do think it's really important for a number of reasons that we often don't talk about, you know, not least, for example, the safety of the people who have to work with individuals in prison in most instances, that people have the hope of release. But if we're going to believe in rehabilitation, even for the majority, you know, we should be under no illusions that there are some people who simply have done things that are beyond the pale, and that the risk that they present to the public, you know, is always that outbalances any presumption that we should release them. And Pitchfork is one of those. He's not just like any other murderer, indeed. You know, most people who kill someone who's known to them. To kill two 15-year-old girls, you know, in one instance, while he left his infant son sleeping in a car, yeah. You know, in who are strangers to him in sexual offences, tells you, I think, all you need to know about the fact that he was ever going to be a risky individual. And at odds with the parole board's proclamations that he could be managed safely in the community is some 43 restrictive conditions imposed on his license.
Right.
You know, this was just a gamble that never needed to be taken.
Well, exactly right, because I remember thinking at the time, well, I'll tell you what, if you are putting all of these conditions on his release, then surely that would suggest it's not safe to release him.
And don't get me wrong, you know, there are calculated risks there with some individuals. You know, if someone has killed while under the influence of drink or drugs and then spent 20 years working hard in prison custody to prove that they've changed their character substantially, you know, they've been tested in open conditions, then putting the condition, you know, as one of five or six that they don't visit pubs while they're under the period of their license,
yeah.
You know, might be reasonable. But this, is, like I say, Pitchfork is not a murderer like all others. He is, I think, you know, one of a small number of very dangerous individuals that were not wrapped up under that sort of 2003 legislation that allowed us to make whole life sentences, or allowed judges in that case to make whole life sentences. Oddly, the Home Secretary previous to that had never been involved in the Pitchfork case and had never set the tariff as kind of exceptional. So it is an odd and an exceptional case, but we do have a backlog of those. And when I tell people about this, when I tell people, for example, that you know, there's a young man who at 23 years of age, Jamie Reynolds, got a sentence of life without the possibility of parole, but that someone like Ian Huntley hasn't got that, they find it hard to believe. And I think understandably so.
Right.
You know, in some instances, and I think particularly for those who are captured now under that category that would allow them to be given whole life sentences, where their offences are either linked to sexual killings or where their offences are extremist in ideology, I think those are the ones where really, you know, the parole board needs to think again, perhaps, about whether safe release in those cases is ever realistic or achievable. Because with what's happened with Pitchfork doesn't just damage the case for the parole board generally, and actually they're quite good quite often at releasing less serious offenders and putting conditions on them. It blows back onto the whole of what they do.
It does.
And that's the issue.
Well, that's the point. I mean, and nobody would suggest, I'm like you, James, I'm not somebody that says people shouldn't be released, people shouldn't be given a second chance, but it's not a one-size-fits-all parole board, and you can't say that everybody should be treated in the same way. And I think, and I wonder whether when Dominic Raab talks about a reform of the parole board so that it becomes more sort of user-friendly for victims and for victims' families, whether that's kind of what he means. Because let's face it, the thing about Pitchfork is that if he was sentenced in the last 10 years, or more recently anyway, than he was, he would have probably had a whole life sentence and he wouldn't have had any chance of parole.
Absolutely. And I think in some ways, I'm even slightly uncomfortable with the the wholesale badging this as a rebalancing towards victims, because, you know, what an individual feels as a victim in some ways about the offence should be, in some ways, and I say this respectfully of victims, but it should be a secondary consideration in a way, because, for example, if we take the case of a young man who's killed another young man on a deprived inner city estate in a night crime, for example, you know, one set of parents of one victim might feel, you know, that he should spend the rest of his life in prison custody. Another may come from an ideology where they are very forgiving of what he's done and feel that, you know, should he express some remorse, he should come out very, very quickly and punishment won't work. That shouldn't necessarily be the consideration for me. The consideration of why the state keeps people in prison custody is because they've done something horrendous for which they're being punished, but also, you know, to protect the public. And the core consideration for me in these instances, and others as well that are linked to it with cases like that of John Warboys, but also where, for example, we've seen extremist prisoners freed and then, you know, when and then go on to do serious further offences. The real consideration has to be the paramount of public protection over the rights of the individual. There are some instances where someone has done something so terrible, so wicked, so bad, that you can never say that they won't be a risk to the public, because the best predictor of future behaviour, and I always say this to my students at Staffordshire University, the best predictor of future behaviour is past behaviour. And if someone has killed two young females in crimes that are sexually motivated, they will always, always be a risk. And for me, they have lost the right to liberty. That individual. Now, the problem is, you know, that's quite an exceptional case. And for the vast majority of murders, and one of the reasons I do say to people, you know, I think that there has to be the aspect of rehabilitation in murder. I've sat opposite a lot of murderers, you know, and many of them have sat opposite me, telling me about what they've done, breaking down as they recall the horror of what they've done, because the person whose life they've taken is either a very, very close friend or a family member. And they do genuinely show, you know, that remorse, and then will work towards a system where they can be released. And the vast majority of life sentence prisoners like that we release don't reoffend. But they're not like Colin Pitchfork, you know. So I think we do need a rebalancing, and we do need a rebalancing towards sense where public protection has to in some instances trump the rights of the individual.
Oh, I think there's no question about that. I mean, it's like paedophiles. I like you, worked with an awful lot of very interesting people. I'll say that word. I once interviewed a paedophile who begged me to try and get somebody to take him back to prison, because he said, as long as I'm out, I'm a danger to children. And he knew that because he couldn't help himself. And he said, you know, I don't wish to be outside because it's going to be torture for me not to do some harm to someone. And he walked out of my recording studio. I was up in Edinburgh at the time, straight to a shopping centre, which was across the street. And God knows what happened to him. God knows where he is now. But, you know, these are people who understand that they are not right in the head, if you like, and they shouldn't be released. But what's your view as well, though, James? I'm interested in this because I was talking to a barrister yesterday who was giving me all this guff about how, you know, depending on what you sentence people to, they will behave differently before and possibly during the crime they're committing. Is there any issue there?
I think with a small number, I think, you know, you can get calculating offenders who will balance things up and will make rational decisions in crime. But an awful lot of crime isn't that rational. You know, a lot of crime, it happens under the influence of drink or drugs, where people don't consider what they're doing, you know. So it's difficult to kind of suggest that the main thing, I think, in the offender's mind is the calculation of the sentence. It happens with some, you know. So, for example, you know, we've seen situations with very serious armed robbers, for example, where even the armament that they'll choose or the way that they'll try and go about undertaking a job is calculated so that, you know, they won't face the most kind of severe sentences or sanctions.
No.
You know, there's a reason that the Hatton Garden guys went about their offence in the way that they did, at least in part because it only opens them up to burglary, and they know that there's a lesser custodial sentence.
Yeah.
You know, But an awful lot of offenders don't act or don't think in quite that way. And I think when we're thinking about, you know, the compulsion that's in individuals like Pitchfork towards their crimes, you know, he was rational and calculating and clearly very deceptive after the case.
Yeah, what a surprise. I mean, but why would they not see through that, though? That's my point.
Yeah, no, and I think, you know, and I think this is where, as well, we do need to recognise that, you know, so I think for some people, they regard rehabilitation, and like I say, I'm a believer in rehabilitation for most, but there's a tendency to see everybody as savable, and yeah, that's the danger for me.
Right.
You know, I think there are some, as I say, that do go beyond the pale. You know, if you've expressed an extremist ideology, for example, where you've gone past the point of merely liking some posts on social media into the realms of, you know, preparing a bomb that's going to blow up women and children in a maternity hospital, for example, you know, I'm then very loath to think that, you know, I can be convinced necessarily that it's safe for you to be in public. Again, the gravity of that offence, the severity of it, outweighs, you know, any judgment that I would make about the individual's redemption. And perhaps, you know, if you really want to prove that you've been redeemed, and I certainly had this in the case of one lifer who said, I will never come out of prison custody. And in part, I will never come out of prison custody because I accept what I did. And this is my sentence. I want to pay for it by never coming out again. That proves to you, that should prove to you that I'm rehabilitated. And I mean, that one really does blow the mind. But there, you know, but there is, he was kind of acknowledging what he had done. And I think, you know, with some individuals, and with the gravity of offences of some of those that we're locking up, you know, their very desire to come out again is perhaps also indicative of the fact that they haven't fully accepted just, you know, the gravity of what they've done.
And people like Pitchfork may wish to come out again in order to carry on doing what he did before he went in. You know, there's also that possibility as well, isn't there? James, this is good to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. James Treadwell, Professor of Criminology at Staffordshire University. See, the point about this is, I still haven't heard an apology from the parole board for making such a blunder as to let this guy out. We also haven't really seen, and I can't make any head nor tail or sense of this statement they've read out to me and given to me, as to whether or not they're going to attempt to release him again. It's not clear whether he is now no longer eligible for release or whether he now still is eligible for release.
This is Talk Radio across the UK, online, on DAB Plus, and on the Talk Radio app. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. Now, I've got something to say, and it's an important thing that I have to say. Not that everything I say is not important, because everything I say is obviously important. But here we are in 2021. It is, of course, the 23rd of November. It's Thanksgiving week, if you happen to be of an American bent. It's also time to think about award ceremonies, because, you know, there's the Oscars, there's the Golden Globes, there's the Brits, of course, and there's the Grammys. Now, the Brits has been renamed this morning by the Sun as the Twits. And the reason they've said that is because the Brits has gone gender neutral. Now, you might be very surprised to know that actually, I think it's a good thing. Piers Morgan doesn't. Piers Morgan says that it's wokeism gone mad. Piers Morgan says that they are being utterly ridiculous by doing away with best male singer, best male performer, best female performer. But I say Piers is wrong about this, because guess what? Actually, the good thing about this is that the Brit Awards will now be shorter. There won't be as many awards to give out. And at the end of the day, what difference does it make if you're a man or a woman? Either you sell the most records and you sell the most albums, like Adele will probably do this year and probably win everything. Adele is a woman. So what? You know, if Michael Jackson was still alive and people didn't hate him, maybe he would win some awards. He could be the best singer of the year. It doesn't matter whether he's a man or a woman, does it? According to the piece in The Sun today, people think that it's gone ridiculously crazy. Tom Hunt, an Ipswich MP for the Tory party, who's appeared on this show many times, says, whatever next? Will it be the Spice People? Will it be the Backstreet Persons? Well, no, it doesn't matter, does it? If you put out the best album of the year, what difference does it make what gender you are? If you're the best performer of the year, what difference does it make what gender you are? I mean, the idea that people are getting wound up about this is quite remarkable. And as I said, I think the shorter the Brit Awards are, the better. I hate award ceremonies. I don't like looking at them. I don't like watching them. I watched a little bit of Adele's audience with the other night, which was absolutely sick-making. It was awful. I think she's going to appear on Plank of the Week this week, which we're filming later on. But the idea that somehow, just because Sam Smith is now gender neutral, this has happened. And I think that's why it's happened, because they didn't know what to do with Sam Smith, because Sam Smith doesn't know whether he's going to enter best male or best female, because he's neither. He's apparently best something in the middle. And you can't add to the awards by making people get an award for being gender neutral. So this seems to me to be the way to go. The Brits not having any gender is fine. It's absolutely fine. I don't know why people are getting so worked up. And I think Piers Morgan on this occasion is wrong, because it's not wokeism gone mad. It's common sense. And if they can cut a few hours out of the ridiculous backslapping fest that goes on every single year for all of these lovies who sing for a living, I don't think that's a bad thing at all. So I take my hat off to the Brit Awards. I think you've done the right thing. You're not twits. You're doing something right. And that, unusually, is something that I will recognise and that I will celebrate. And I will say, well done to the Brits. Well done for joining the modern world. We don't need genders in award ceremonies. What difference does it make? You've either won it or you've come second. Who cares whether you've got some kind of genitalia or other? Doesn't matter.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
It's a delightful day. It's cold. It's crisp. It's November. And Laura Dodsworth is here. Very good morning to you.
Good morning. Do you know, I didn't even notice the weather on the way today.
Did you not?
No.
It's chilly, though.
I was just thinking about the dystopia that's creeping up on us day by day. I didn't even really notice what was going on the way in, because the news has been quite consuming recently, hasn't it?
It really has. I mean, when you see all of the rioting and all of the sort of the tear gas and all of the water cannon being fired at people, and you think, why is this happening? And you wonder what it is that's making the government issue these kinds of instructions to their more or less paramilitary police forces to start attacking their own people.
Why is it happening? Well, the Austrian Interior Minister has called out the increasing radicalisation of people who don't want to be vaccinated, anti-vaxxers. And I thought, hang on a minute. First of all, recently you locked down the unvaccinated.
Yeah.
Now you're going to lock down everyone, because just locking down the unvaccinated wasn't going to work.
Apparently it didn't work. And, imagine that.
And now you're going to force everybody in the country to be vaccinated. I wonder why. I wonder why there's some radicalisation among the population. What a weird way to twist it round. So I wanted to talk about this today because I've been thinking about this for a while. Mm. I've been wondering about writing about it. But the thing is, if you draw comparisons to totalitarianism, you get accused of being too extreme. And, you know, don't mention the Nazis. Yeah. I feel like an episode of Faulty Towers here. Right. Don't mention the Nazis.
Well, I mentioned it once, don't so I mention think the I got Nazis. Away with it.
But the thing is, totalitarianism doesn't arrive overnight.
No.
It creeps up on you. And then Lord Sumption brought out a great article in The Telegraph yesterday. I thought, right, if it's good enough for Jonathan Sumption, it's good enough for me. I'm going to stand shoulder to shoulder with him.
Yeah.
I think we do have a problem. Look, we don't live in a totalitarian country. This is still a democracy.
Yeah.
But there are signs of authoritarianism and totalitarianism which are creeping up around Europe, which are very troubling early warning signs I think we need to pay attention to.
I think we absolutely do. Do you know what I think about this government is that this government is less totalitarian since Matt Hancock left it. I think he was quite keen on that sort of stuff. And I think for all the criticism I've made of Sajid Javid in the past, he does at least seem to have a sort of a sentiment of democracy about him. And when he said at the weekend, and I know that we can't always believe everything they say, but when he said, look, we're not going to in any way mandate vaccination. I mean, again, if I'd been Andrew Marr, who I'm not, I would have said, well, hang on a minute. You've already mandated it for people who are in care homes, and you've already mandated it for people in the NHS. And then he kind of addressed that and said, well, that's different. But is it?
No, it's not different. And actually, you know, I'd love to have a big, broad, sweeping conversation about totalitarianism with you, but it's about the individual. It's about the personal at the other end. The personal, the person at the other end of that metaphorical jackboot. I just published a story in my Substack about a care home worker who's going through the disciplinary process and is about to lose their job. Now, in her case, she's had COVID, okay? And she's got antibodies.
Right.
Okay, so if this was really about medicine, public health, about if it's about science... you could at least let them all have antibody tests,
yes.
Okay? And anybody who's got antibodies doesn't have to be vaccinated, right? And there should also be religious exemptions.
And do antibodies last? I mean, I know this is not a medical... Well, it is a medical question and you're not a medical person, but I don't know the answer to it. Maybe you do. If you have antibodies because you've had COVID, do they stay with you for a long time or a short time or what?
Okay, well, somebody was just saying recently, somebody from... the NHS, I feel useless now because I didn't catch a note of the name, sorry, but on the
That's
BBC
right.
saying that the reason that we're not going to have such a big wave this winter is because we have so much natural immunity,
yes.
because we have more infections
in the
summer.
And we're supposedly ahead of the curve
right.
than Europe, right?
So you can't have it both ways.
Right.
You can't say natural immunity doesn't count in care workers, but oh, we're going to do better this winter because we've got natural immunity. Of course it's got to count for something.
Yeah.
So anyway, this poor person who has sent me their story and I've published it, they had a breakdown last summer because of the stress of lockdowns, which they described as psychological torture, but they love their job. They genuinely, clearly love their job, looking after adults with learning disabilities, has had COVID, has antibodies, doesn't want to be vaccinated, will have to leave their job.
Yeah.
And said to me, you know, that's 10% of the Care Quality
yes.
Commission registered workers who are going to be leaving their jobs. This is decimating an industry.
Yeah.
And if
well,
you look
it could
at the
be
overall...
as many as, I think, 60,000 people that was the figure I heard.
And what does that do to the overall net benefit of public health? You know, those adults with learning disabilities in this home, they're not going to have a better quality of care because they're now short-staffed. It won't help them live full and meaningful lives, and they won't be safer.
No. So therefore, you have to ask why again, don't you? Because if they're not going to be safer, why is everybody so convinced that is somehow the answer? Because it's one thing for them in this country to nudge us, and you've talked about the nudge unit many times about, you know, if you haven't been vaccinated, please go and get your vaccine, please go and get your booster, it's the best thing you can do, la-di-la. That has turned from a recommendation to a suggestion to an order in Austria.
Absolutely. And not just Austria, also Germany has said that they'll mandate vaccinations for everybody. Now, let's think about what that would look like. Does that look like people being strapped onto gurneys and forcibly vaccinated? That's all very one flew over the cuckoo nest.
Yeah, isn't it just?
Right. Or is it that people won't be allowed to leave their homes or they will be fined and then imprisoned? My opinion is if you have lost bodily sovereignty, you've lost everything.
Yeah.
If you don't have freedom over your body, you don't have freedom.
Right.
And so this is a totalitarian concept that the state can exert absolute control over you.
It is. It's like you turning up, as you say, in one flew over the cuckoo's nest and being handed your medication and your little cup, and you take the pill and you swallow the water.
Yeah, and you have to, otherwise you get the electric shock therapy.
Yeah.
So the World Health Organization have said this as well. That
And now they've joined in, haven't they?
Yeah, that vaccine mandates should be a last resort when persuasion hasn't worked. But this is missing the point again. If you try to persuade somebody and then they say no, I believe that's where it should be left. No means no.
Well, do you know,
my body, my choice.
Isn't it funny? Because that applies in every other case, including in sexual matters. If you say no, that means no. It doesn't mean yes, maybe.
Yeah.
Means no. And the same people who would say to you, you must have a vaccination, would defend that as a principle, wouldn't they?
Yes, but no doesn't mean no in totalitarian states.
No.
That's the thing. Let's look at China, where they've had basically compulsory contraception and sterilisation when they had the one-child policy.
Yeah.
And there were also anecdotal reports of forced abortions, even at late stage.
Right.
Okay, so the state had absolute control over people's bodies.
Right.
Now, we're not China. We're a democracy. But what we're seeing is a tipping point in Western, liberal, democratic countries where the state is saying, actually, no, we do want to have control over this one aspect. But you have to have a line. You have to hold a line. We're in danger of crossing a Rubicon here.
Yeah.
And the most important thing is to protect the freedoms that make being a human worthwhile, that make life worthwhile.
Well, you remember Neil Ferguson saying once in one of his many interviews that at the beginning, they looked at what China was doing to control the spread of the virus and thought, we'd never get away with that here. I think those were his words.
Yeah.
But then, later, said, do you know, actually, we probably could have done. You know, where people that I know who know people in China were telling me that you would come home from, say, a visit abroad, and you would be told to quarantine in your home, and they would literally come and sort of seal up the door, and they'd put a camera on the front, and if you went out, you'd get arrested and put in jail.
Yeah, it's a form of medical imperialism, and it's why virologists and medical people shouldn't be in charge.
Well, this is it, and this is a really important point, I think, because we have fallen, or some parts of our society have fallen for this kind of ludicrous notion that because you've got a degree in something, or because you're an expert in something, that somehow you can then therefore dictate to us how we should be living. I'm not having that.
No, and I think that the idea that a mandatory QR code enables your participation in life is something that people should be worried about. Don't forget that when the UK vaccine passport was first revealed, the curtains slipped a little. Yeah. And do you remember we saw functionality on there that was nothing to do with vaccination status? There were things like ethnicity, criminal convictions, alleged criminal behaviour. Mm. What has that got to do with being potentially infectious and going into a nightclub? Nothing.
Right.
So the app was built with all of this functionality, and that's been the same when we've seen the curtain slip on other passports around the world. And it looks quite similar to the social credit system in China. So like I keep saying, we're not China, we are a democracy, but there are these signs coming in that the state wants to exert complete control over your bodily autonomy. I mean, the other things that are indicative of authoritarianism and totalitarianism are emergency powers.
Yeah.
We still have emergency powers, and they contained extreme powers. Also, the legitimacy of those powers are constantly justified by the use of fear. So the crisis maintains the imposition of these increasing and continuing interruptions to our freedom, and there's been very minimal political opposition. So we're not living under one party rule, but the opposition has been spineless.
Not only that, but quite encouraging of it in the sense that either they wanted it done earlier or harder or longer.
Yeah.
Right.
And there's a suppression of opposition from other quarters as well. You know, scientists, journalists and politicians have been censored. Videos have been removed from YouTube. There were Ofcom rules which inhibited the discussion about the public health policy. So when you have that suppression of discussion only in one direction, that's not healthy for democracy either. And then, you know, finally, there's state control over the individual, the state, and also the World Health Organization saying, well, we'll persuade you unless you can't be persuaded, and then we'll make you.
Yeah, I know. It's quite frightening. Laura Dodsworth is here. We're going to stop for a moment. And then we've got some very interesting news to impart to you about something that Laura's been doing without me, would you believe? She's done another show, but I wasn't on it. Anyway, we'll hear more about that coming up very shortly. This is Talk Radio.
This is Talk Radio. Across the UK. Online, on DAB+, and on the Talk Radio app. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham. On Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. We've just been talking about clever people because, of course, here at Talk Radio, we're not clever. People say that we're stupid because, you know, we might be racist and we might have voted for Brexit and we might be just really horrible people. But I'm sitting here with Laura Dodsworth, one of the nicest people I've ever met. And I'm actually, regardless of what some people might say, I'm not a bad guy, honestly. Just ask my ex-wife and she'll tell you. She's not the right person to ask. But I'll tell you what I am going to do now. I'm going to let you listen to a fabulous new show, which was recorded, I think, at the end of last week.
It was.
And it's called Straight Talk, and it stars not just Laura Dodsworth, but Tonya Buxton and Dr. Renee Hundekamp, right? So it's like the three most intelligent women, or some of the most intelligent women I've ever met. They've done this show. Not only have they done it without me, but it's also become the biggest watched and most watched show so far that's been put out over the weekend on Talk Radio. So have a look at this.
So thinking about how governments and companies try to push certain messages across, there have been some really interesting vaccine incentives in the news recently. Did you also see the brothel in Vienna,
yes,
in Austria, that was using vouchers to encourage vaccinations in a pop-up clinic that they were holding inside the brothel?
Yes. I sent that to my other half and he thought it was really funny to reply, wow, I've just booked my flight to Austria. I mean Spain. But it's not funny, is it?
It's not funny.
On the one hand, we've got health messages, and on the other hand, we've got an invite to enter an industry which is not healthy, certainly not mentally for the people involved in it, possibly not from other physical health aspects as well. So that the messages are so mixed.
But the whole thing about incentivising a vaccine is wrong, full stop.
Yes.
End of story, full stop. I mean, why would you need to incentivise something that's going to do you good? Why do you need to do that? It's all about personal choice. And the whole thing about this particular virus is we know that if you're obese or fat or have other health issues, what's not going to help is the incentive we've got here from
McDonald's
in the USA, free beer, pizzas, we've got donuts, we have the most ridiculous things, the most anti-health things are being incentivized in order to take a vaccine for your health.
Yeah.
Get your head around that.
That's very good, that.
Why, thank you.
Very good indeed. And you can get that on YouTube if you haven't watched the whole thing. Go and watch the whole thing. Not now, but later, you know. But congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. It was fun. Yeah,
this is what happens, right? We bring these people here. They go over our heads. They go and get their own show. I mean, you know, that's show business. That's what it's like.
Oh, just trampling all over you to get to the top, Mike.
But, you know, the good thing about being good, which is what we are at Talk Radio, is that we help other people. If you went to the BBC, they wouldn't do that. They would say, oh, no, we can't do that because, you know, somebody might be upset, you know. Oh, you know that woman that does Newsnight, Emily Maitlis, oh, she wouldn't like that. No, can't do that. Andrew Marr's leaving because he can't say what he wants to say, apparently. You know, and it's just, you know, we are painted as this kind of toxic media organisation, when in fact it's the complete opposite. It's everybody else that's toxic.
It's a really interesting point. I saw somebody's comment in relation to this video. It's Straight Talk with me and Tonya. And,
great name, by the way. Yeah. I like the name.
It came straight up to the top of our heads. It's what we want to do. Not clickbait.
Yeah.
Not being salacious or, you know, spin. Nothing crazy. We just want to talk about what's really going
on. And it's a very considered conversation, because the good thing about what we do is we have enough time to do that. It's not all about, you know, 5 minutes here, 2 minutes there.
Yeah, we don't want to shy away from what's really going on in news, but it's not about clickbait. Anyway, somebody said you'll damage your credibility by being on Talk Radio.
Quite right.
Like, what? Well, first of all, I've been on every week with Mike for ages.
Right.
And, you know, from my own point of view, last year during the, you know, those early weeks of the epidemic, I had to stop listening to Radio 4 every morning because I was waking up feeling angry by the coverage, and I switched over to Talk because there's so much more balance. You get so many different interesting guests. You know, you're getting in the, you know, the ministers, the top politicians, and the scientists, but also those counter-narrative points of view, just different points of view.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, I've been listening to it. How can it... I don't believe
which
this kind of
back.
Snobbishness that you might damage your credibility by being on... something that's not the BBC.
But also credibility with whom exactly? With the people who are so close-minded
snobs.
That they believe in everything they're told by the government, even though they hate the government because they hate Tories normally. But they believe everything they say about health. And you kind of go, because this takes us back, doesn't it, to the European model, which is now currently going on as a kind of totalitarian thing, where if you don't believe what they're telling you, there's something wrong with you. Because that's the other thing they do, isn't it? Orwellian kind of behaviour. Therapy.
Totally. Well, it seems to have had a good reaction so far. We talked about the Tesco ad, obviously. Orb's got to talk about Father Christmas brandishing a QR code. These crazy vaccine incentives, because, I mean, the world has gone quite mad when we've got to the stage where you can shag for a jab or have a joint for a jab or a donut for a jab or enter a raffle for a college education for a jab. It's a bit nuts.
It really is.
We talked about that. And also J.K. Rowling being cancelled from her own 20th anniversary show. So things that people are thinking about, but they're not necessarily being brave enough to have the conversation about.
Well, that's the thing. An awful lot of people who say that, you know, these things are literally not being talked about anywhere else. And they're really not.
Mm.
You know, so we're very proud of what we do. And I'm very proud of you and what you've done. And I will continue to do what I do. And we will. And that's why we keep getting bigger. Because people are coming to us. And there are still people that don't know about us. So spread the word to as many people as possible. I got in a
cab
the other
day. People haven't heard of Talk yet.
Yeah, because
this
we've never, do you know what, we've never advertised. We have never advertised. The only time we've ever had an advert was in a couple of the newspapers here inside the building. But we've never had an outdoor kind of poster campaign. We've never had anything like that. So a lot of people still don't know we are here. So it's always worth spreading the word to people.
Well, that's true. I mean, I heard about you through word of mouth. A friend sent me some clips of Talk Radio, and it was like a parched person in a desert finding an oasis.
Yes.
It's like, bathe me in this common sense. Give me more. I found you on the radio. Yes, there we go. I didn't need an ad, I was told.
There you go. And that is sometimes the best way as well, because if somebody does tell you that. But it is extraordinary. The bigger we get, of course, the more opposition we get as well. And the more people that come out and basically paint you as this horrible individual and, you know, well, you're obviously a racist and you can't possibly, you know. And also now, Peter Hitchens talks about this a lot, that people have lost the ability to understand that they might not agree with you about one thing, but they could agree with you about something else. Now that's gone. If they disagree with you, everything you say is therefore wrong, and so you can't have a point of view about anything. They either love you or they hate you, and what you're actually saying they're not even listening to.
It's so unfortunate. You know, we all have to share this patch of earth together. You have to be able to hold hands across the aisle.
Yeah.
You have to be able to cope with people having different points of view. It's fine. And you can also approach the conversations politely.
Great row yesterday about Colin Pitchfork, this horrible murderer who was released on parole and then had to be recalled to prison because he did exactly what we said he would do, which was he started to interfere with young women again. And I had this great row with this barrister, which got quite personal, quite heated. And he sent me a message after him saying, I really enjoyed that. And that's what we should be doing, right? You know, you can be, I mean, I grew up arguing in a family of Scottish people who just spent the time arguing around the dinner table. That was our hobby. If you asked me what my hobby was when I was a teenager, it was arguing. And that's what I love to do. And I don't fall out with people because they disagree with me. And if they call me a name or I call them, and it doesn't matter. It's all part of the cut and thrust of life. And I might even nick some of their arguments and use them against somebody else the next time.
Do you know, it's the same for me, growing up with constant conversation, constant debate, interrupting each other probably over the dinner table, but non-stop talking. I think it's a healthy way to be.
Yeah.
My ex's family wasn't like that. They never disagreed. They never talked about things. No. And I found it really hard,
it's
this
difficult,
polite,
isn't it,
stilted
to
conversation.
Sit around the table and just kind of cut up your food and, so what did you do today?
I know. If you're not chucking food over the table at each other while you're arguing, you're not really having a meal, are you?
Exactly.
I'm kidding.
No, but I mean, it's the food of, literally the food and staff of life is conversation, you know? And if it's all just nicey-nicey, there's not much point, really.
No, but, you know, this is this whole thing with cancel culture at the moment. It's why we talked about J.K. Rowling.
Yeah.
Imagine leaving the originator of that incredible set of stories and franchise out of the anniversary film.
It's pretty rude, apart from anything else.
Because people don't like her alleged transphobia. It's incredibly
rude.
But she
isn't transphobic anyway.
Of course she's not. She wrote a fantastic essay in 2020 arguing how trans rights shouldn't be incompatible with women's rights, that women have a uniquely female experience.
Right.
And to leave her out of the 20th anniversary film is pathetic. I mean,
really,
I wouldn't want to watch it, because the thing I'm interested in is the person that wrote the story. That's where it all started. It started with her. So how can you leave her out? But this intolerance for different viewpoints is really, it's making life boring, actually.
Well, it's making it ridiculous in a way as well, because people are failing to see the irony in it. You know, that you're actually cancelling the person that created the thing that you're celebrating.
Okay. You're right. That is ironic.
Isn't it?
It is.
But they don't see that, because they have no sense of humour. And in any sense of... you must have a sense of the ridiculous. That was the other thing my father always taught me, is you must not only have a sense of ridiculous, but know how sometimes ridiculous you are yourself. Because then you're completely unhurtable. Nobody can come at me and tell me anything that I don't already know about myself. If they start giving me a hard time, I'm going, so? Is that the best you can do?
You're right. We need a very healthy sense of the ridiculous at the moment to cope with life anyway, don't we?
Yeah, definitely. Well, listen, we'll be getting you back for Plank soon, I dare say. But
I'd love to.
Well done on the straight talk thing.
Thank you.
And we'll see you next week.
See you then.
Laura Dodsworth. And of course, more of your calls, more from Kevin O'Sullivan coming up as well. He doesn't agree with me that Boris Johnson is basically ripping it all out of us by pretending to be a bumbling oaf. He's not. He really isn't.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Now, let us talk to Jeevan Sander, economist, former Treasury official, about what is going on in the social care sector, because the cost of social care has been crippling people for many, many a year. And we do need to sort this all out, don't we? Jeevan, a very good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Mike.
Thanks very much indeed for talking to us. I mean, it's such a complicated issue, this. I don't really know where to start, because, you know, there are people who can't afford to put their relatives in care. There are people working in the care sector who can't stay there because they're not going to be vaccinated. There are people running care homes, making a fortune. You know, I mean, it's a sort of panoply of madness, isn't it?
Yeah, the care sector has always had, well, has had a lot of problems for a lot of years. I mean, look, 1.5 million older people not getting the care they need, people being left for days at a time without food, without being checked up on. It absolutely needs to be fixed. Now, the real things about these plans, and here's kind of the real top line here. Under the original plans, you had a house worth 100K, you would lose about 45% of your assets.
Right.
The plans that the government snuck out last week means that person on £100,000 who has that house will now lose 80% of their assets if they face the maximum cost of care. Mm. If you have a £500,000 house, you only lose 20% of your assets. These new plans, it protects the wealthiest pensioners. The least wealthiest end up contributing the most proportionally, and the rest of us have to pay higher taxes as well. There's a reason the government didn't openly announce this, because they know how absurd it is. And it's time to go back to the original proposal. The other thing is, it doesn't even save that much money, about 0.1%, in order to take houses away from the least wealthiest.
Yeah. And so how is it going to be altered, do you think? Because I was reading a piece in the Standard just a few moments ago, which has just come out, in which they're suggesting that it's going to be butchered in the House of Lords anyway. It's more than likely to come back for its second reading in a very much different form. Some of the backbenchers of the Tory party want to see the cap lifted anyway. So is it going to end up being another one of these inevitable U-turns?
I suspect so. I mean, the majority was very much reduced. Also, we know how restive the Conservative backbenchers are. We should also remember as well, this is hitting Conservative MPs. I think 3 out of 4 seats they won off Labour last time, houses or average house prices are about to be hit the hardest by this social care change. And as you can see, it's leading the headline this morning. I suspect we're going to see a U-turn, but not in the kind of the full U-turn we expect from this government. What they tend to do is kind of U-turn most of the way, but not all the way, to save some face.
No, quite. And as far as the way that this can be solved in the long run, I've always been slightly troubled by the way it's funded. I've often thought that there would be a better plan if we had a sort of separate entity outside of the NHS, outside of councils, and just independently run, non-for-profit, as a kind of administrative arm, at least, of the social care sector. Is that something that you would look at?
I mean, that's up to the care providers. I mean, the problem at the moment is, I know the care sector has huge issues. The problem they have at the moment is really about funding and actually the way we fund it. Now, we could have funded out our general taxation, so we're not going down that road. Another way is actually just to cap people's assets who end up paying 15 to 20% across the board, rather than having this kind of system where if you have very little assets, you pay a lot of proportion of your assets away in this, under these new plans. If you have like a lot of assets, you have that £86,000 cap, which basically means you keep most of your very nice house, usually in London, the southeast.
Right. And of course, the problem for a lot of families as well is that they have an asset, but the only asset is the house, and they hope that they at some point can pass it on to their children. Is there any alternative to this method whereby they could keep hold of that asset, albeit that it might only be a house that's worth £120,000 or £130,000 outside of London? You know, is there a way that they could fund it differently?
Well, the two other ways would be basically, and the first and foremost, just have a general increase in taxation to pay for it. But that would mean kind of a rise for all of us. The other thing this government could do actually is just to tax the wealthiest people in this country. You could reform capital gains tax and get about £5 billion out of there, get another £5 billion if you tax transaction in the city, another £2 billion from a mansion tax of those over £2 million. There's your £12 billion altogether. You can probably get it up to £13 that you need to in order to kind of pay for these bills. So there is certainly a way to do it, and there are ways to shift around the taxation to do so. It's really about the political will. And dare I say, if you're a government who has lots of wealthy home-owning pensioners, clearly they don't want to hit them at this particular point in time.
No, because, I mean, that was Theresa May's difficulty, wasn't it? And also the other problem, I think, for this party of the Tories at the moment is that they're already being accused of being the party of high tax and high public spending, and they probably, I can't imagine, want to go any higher.
Yeah, I mean, look, they've got a political coalition that's moving in two different directions, right? They've got those kind of high-earning kind of young people or working age people, and now they've got this kind of new set of voters that generally do have homes but aren't as kind of rich as their old part of their political coalition is. Starting to see that kind of pull apart slightly with these particular plans.
Yeah. And I mean, it's only going to get worse, this, isn't it? Because as people live longer, as people, are healthier longer, I suppose, as well, with luck, are there even enough care homes at the moment to cope with it?
At this point in time, we're hearing about huge shortages in the care sector. I know at the moment they're having to increase wages to kind of attract people into the kind of scheme. It's certainly true we're living longer. That's very, very good news. The other thing I would look at is kind of, the general health of the population. Now, at the moment, we live in a country where, for example, 1 in 10 adults is going hungry. We know that if you don't have enough money, you can't turn on the heating, you're stressed out, it hits your healthcare later on. So actually, we're building up these long-term health problems by not ensuring that today people are living good and healthy lives. And one way to do that is actually ensuring that if you are working full-time, you shouldn't be choosing between heating and eating.
Yeah. The other big problem for me, though, as well, is this new tax that they're bringing in, a national insurance expansion of 1.25% in April, which they say is going to be for the NHS and for social care. I mean, I'm not convinced, really, because I'm assuming that, one, they can't even really guarantee that it's going to go into the NHS and help cut back on the length of time people are waiting for procedures, because that doesn't seem to be being affected at all at the moment. I mean, they can't, it's going to be very hard for them to ring fence any of that, isn't it?
Well, they can find a way to kind of technically hypothecate the funding forward, right? You can always find a way to put 12 billion additional back. But look, it is a very unfair tax rise. Mm. I mean, if you want 30k a year, you're going to pay £500 from this national insurance wise. And I want to be clear to your listeners, it's £500, it's not £250. Mm. If you're putting up taxes on employers and employees, the employer is taking that money out of your paycheck, even if it's not on your pay slip. Mm. So £500 a year for someone on 30k, we know how much bills are rising as well. And particularly members of my generation having to pay more in taxes, you know, in order to protect the assets of the wealthy, whilst also we can't afford homes. It's an absurdity.
It is rather unusual, isn't it? But that is the problem, though, with government right now, isn't it? Because everything's kind of a movable, I wouldn't say movable feast, but it's not really a feast. It's not quite a famine either. But you know, everything kind of is moving around. The cost of energy is ludicrously high. It doesn't show any signs of abating. The cost of fuel is ridiculously high. The cost of everything else is going up. I mean, every time I go and buy anything, it seems to be more expensive than the last time I bought it. And I'm fortunate enough not to have to worry too much about that. But a lot of people do. And there's a lot of stuff now that people just simply can't afford.
Yeah, prices are definitely increasing. And look, I'd say generally speaking, of course, these are global factors, right? We're seeing, you know, energy price rises across the world. We're seeing shipping container costs rising as well. But this government hasn't really helped in that particular regards. There weren't enough visas, for example, for truck drivers 6 months ago when McDonald's were running out of milkshakes. That's increasing costs. We don't have enough gas storage in this country to kind of ensure that we're getting there. We still don't have enough kind of nuclear power plants to give us reliable energy. So there are decisions that this government and previous governments have made that have made this cost of living crisis higher. On top of that, a cut to universal credit that's still coming of 4 billion, that means those kind of who are the low income of society, part-time workers, the disabled, are about to see a huge loss of income while bills are rising by hundreds of pounds. I mean, we're all feeling it. I'm certainly reticent to turn the heating on at the moment. I'm sure lots of your listeners at home are much the same.
Cold today as well. I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? Once inflation really kicks in, I mean, what happens to this government then? Because I don't see the Labour Party really necessarily providing the answer, because not many people see that. And I'm not even sure they've got the wherewithal to get themselves re-elected as leaders and potential governments, you know. But what do you think will be? It's almost as though we're kind of going from one crisis to another, and the crisis, you know, like the HGV crisis comes and goes. You know, the petrol crisis comes and goes. It's still kind of there, but it's not at sort of peak worry time, you know what I mean? And you wonder what, if anything, is going to destabilise Boris Johnson and this government. Like I said, I don't, his act yesterday, I think, was exactly that, just an act pretending that he couldn't even remember what he was saying and where he was in his speech. I mean, nobody's that daft, even him.
I mean, I don't know the kind of the mind of Boris Johnson. I would say that generally speaking, administrations take on the character of the principal. Mm. Okay, so if Boris Johnson is kind of somewhat chaotic, tries to do things at the last minute, that's the way his administration is going to run as well. Civil servants can only do what comes from the top. The second thing is what do voters ask themselves when they tend to vote? They ask themselves, is the leader competent? Will this government make me better off, and do their values align with my own? And the problem is that if you've got a time and you look at the leader and you go, this guy isn't very competent. And I would say actually the past couple of weeks, we see some real shocking decisions by this government. Mm. Better off, like you say, inflation, it hits everyone's particular incomes. That question then does become very live as to, okay, now I'm going to start to look at the alternatives in the opposition. We know that yesterday, Keir Starmer gave a very well-received speech at the CBI. He certainly seems to be increasing in the polls and also growing in confidence as well as aggression against this government.
Well, what was interesting was that he came up in the polls ahead of the Tories when he was in isolation. When he came back, he went back down again.
At the moment, look, I'm starting to see, like, I think Labour at a 3 to 4 point lead. I think we've seen a steady improvement in his rating since his conference speech in October. He certainly seems to be more kind of forceful in the job, which is what people were calling for him to do, at the same time as Boris Johnson clearly is on the way down. And we're seeing today, of course, lots of stories about senior Tories saying you have to fix that operation in Downing Street. And the problem is, it's never really the advisers, it's the guy that's choosing and picking them. And that's Boris Johnson. I personally don't see him changing, but of course we will see what.
No, but that's the thing. I mean, there's not many people out there, I would say, Jeevan, who would have a good word to say about Boris Johnson. I mean, apart from people who are rigidly loyal to him in his own party, but probably if you got them on their own, they might not even say that. But yet, there he is, you know, the bumbling continues, you know, the spending continues, the U-turns continue. I mean, it seems as though there's nothing he can do, really, to get himself in a bad position.
Well, it's like you said, I mean, no one seems to have like a, you know, a kind of heartfelt loyalty towards him. They voted for him because they thought he was a winner. The moment where it looks like he's going to lose, I suspect there won't be a lot of residual goodwill and good faith inside the Conservative benches. And look, we're saying the Tories are slipping behind. The Tories are slipping behind as and when it is November and prices still are increasing. We'll see where we are in 2 months' time in what is going to be a very cold winter. And I'm expecting more of these kind of decisions and these kind of flubs to come from this government, because nothing indicates to me that it is going to change. So I suspect the Conservatives are now looking around. I suspect we might end up seeing a lot more speeches by leading Conservatives, maybe in the early next year, kind of setting out their stall. I know Liz Truss was apparently at Conservative conference drumming up support. We of course know the Chancellor is also looking at the lead as well. So we will see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, I think Liz Truss is a more likely contender really than Rishi Sunak, don't you?
Well, it could be. I mean, look, I have no idea who the kind of Conservative membership will choose. I say they voted once for a leader in the past, what, 15 years, since Cameron came in 2005. Yeah. And that person was Boris Johnson. So, I mean, they certainly, as a party, they're quite old and quite, if you like, tribal, like quite core Conservative voters. They go for the person who fundamentally makes them feel the best about being a Conservative, and that person could be Liz Truss.
Yeah, I wonder. I mean, I'm sorry that we've veered off into sort of political theory here, but I was talking to Tom Hunt the other day about this and how there's supposed to be a kind of bit of a, shall we say, a frisson between the new intake of Red Wall type MPs, young MPs, who are nothing like the old sort of Shire Conservative Party associations and the Rees Moggs of this world, and they're all looked upon as a sort of slightly upstarty, you know. So it'd be interesting to see how that all plays out, really.
Yeah, it will be. I mean, look, like I said, we've got these coalitions kind of pulling apart. The question is, who comes to the membership and who will the MPs accept for that final two? And the fact that we're even talking about Conservative leadership elections and contenders kind of shows you where the current government is. I mean, I don't think any of us would have thought when Boris Johnson won an 80-seat majority, he might not last a full term. And yet this is where we are kind of 2 years in. So I would be very worried if I was Boris Johnson, and also I'd be worried if I was a Conservative MP as well.
But there again, back in the heady days of December 2019, we didn't really know what coronavirus was either.
No, we didn't. That was a nice time.
I mean, it does seem a long way away, doesn't it? Let me finish up finally, Jeevan, just with your thoughts on the future for care homes then. I mean, in the next 12 months or so, are we going to see any changes, do you think, or is it all going to take rather a long time?
I think it's going to take rather a long time. We know this 12 billion extra, most of it's going to the NHS in the first 3 years to deal with the backlogs. We also know there aren't enough beds inside the NHS, which is causing knock-ons into care homes as well. I wouldn't expect overnight improvements. And the other thing, of course, to say is this money, this package, the idea was to change how kind of assets were dealt with and not necessarily about kind of how the funding is getting there. So I would expect it's going to be a slow and difficult road ahead.
Yeah, I suspect you're probably right. Jeevan, thank you very much indeed. Jeevan Sander, economist, former Treasury official, there talking about the care home bill, which went through, of course, last night. It was not defeated. There wasn't a big enough rebellion against it, but there are just enough probably Tory MPs on the backbenches who will ask for changes to be made to it. The House of Lords is likely to be changing bits of it as well. The question really is it totally and utterly unfair to expect people to have to give up their home in order to pay for their social care when they're old? I think it's totally ridiculous. I think it's awful. Imagine trying to leave your house to your children, but it ends up that you have to sell the house in order to pay for your own care, and they get left with nothing. Effectively, there's no point in buying a house, is there?
Talk Radio across the UK, online, on DAB, and on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
If you enjoyed that, be sure to catch the whole show 10 to 1, Monday to Friday, on Talk Radio via DAB, online, or via the Talk Radio app. And if you have an opinion on the stories we cover, we'd love to hear from you. Call us on 0344 499 1000 or tweet at Talk Radio during the show to have your say.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.